So, it's time for a start. Welcome to this brand new week and this lecture on virtual machines. So we started to look at the translation of Prolog. And for that, we first tried to agree on the syntactical categories, which may occur in a Prolog program, or which a Prolog program may consist of. So, and I may quickly recall what we have seen there last time. So the first thing is, there are terms. So Prolog programs operate on terms, and terms are either atoms, variables, anonymous variables, or constructor applications. And this constructor, one particular constructor which we have seen, is so the typical way is to that you write them, the constructors, in front of their arguments. But there is one distfix constructor for list construction. And this distfix, I may recall, was this one. So distfix means so that the operator consists of several parts which are grouped somehow around the arguments. So here it is, the vertical bar, to separate the two arguments and these brackets around them. Yeah? So, and this is an in principle, this list constructor is an untyped list constructor, as every constructor in Prolog is untyped. So we expect the tail of the list to be a list again. But there's no reason why this should be the case. So this would be also a well-formed term. Yeah? Or something. Yeah. So this is a kind of a... So in this sense, the list constructor is not a list constructor, but just a binary constructor. In some sense, it is nothing else but a pair. And so it's, since it's untyped, you can do everything with pairs. So in that sense, it slightly resembles to Lisp, where also... Actually, the list constructor, there is a pair and nothing more. Okay. So that is what I... about terms. And also, so terms contain variables. So in these terms are not only the program terms contain variables, but also Prolog computes with terms containing unbound variables. So also the result, whatever the result might be, of program execution could be... terms with variables. So this is this amazing thing which makes Prolog different from other types of languages. Yeah. So, for example, one thing, if the result, for example, we will later see what the result of, I may recall here in this example, what is the result of this program. The result of this program is a binding of the variables in the query, which makes the query true. Yeah, which makes the statement true. So this means a value for X, a value for Y, and a value for Z. So what value for X should we use? A. What value for Y should we use? B. And what value for a set should we use? C. Yeah? And then these values for this binding, so to speak, of the variables in the query make the query true. And it could be, so for other queries, that these terms which I have written here on the right-hand side of these bindings, that these contain variables themselves. This could be possible, yeah. And in this sense, the result, if the red things here is the result of the program execution, the result of a computed by a Prolog program may contain variables. And that means, what does it mean if there's a variable? That means that you can insert everything there for the variable. So you can replace then the variable with 5 to... with A, B, C, and whatnot, and it always would be give a true statement. I mean every variable on the right. can be instantiated. The variables on the left here are bound by the term provided to the right. Yeah? So it's a binding of variables to values as the answer of to the query executed in red, displayed in yellow. Okay? You have a kind of an idea what's going on here? Okay. So that is that was the thing with the terms. The next thing which we is these kind of goals. And there are two kinds of goals, once again. One is a literal. So this states that the predicate P holds for terms T1 to TK. Okay, so that is one kind of literal. That is one kind of goal, a literal. And the other one is a unification goal. So this states that the variable X should be bound to something which is of the form T, and T may itself contain other variables. Yeah? So this is a unification goal, in that the meaning is that when I have a solution for everything, then X has a value which equals the value of T when I substitute the variables in there. So this in particular means that if I have somewhere such a unification statement in my unification goal in my program, what will the what will we know about this kind of goal? There is no X which satisfies this goal. Yeah, because whatever I substitute into the X, it will never be the case that the left hand side is equal to the right hand side. Yeah? So this means if you want to enforce that something goes wrong, then we write this. If we want to, yeah. Or we may write that. Okay, so that was the thing with the goals. Now, then we have the clauses. So that is, in some sense, the program consists of these rules, which I call them also, or we may call them, in the logical terminology, this is clauses. So what is it? So we have the conclusion that P holds for X1 to XK, given that X1 to XK, that is satisfy the goals G1 to GR. Yeah? Once the goals are satisfied, when the preconditions are satisfied, then we may draw the conclusion. Okay? So they kind of, so this is kind of the knowledge somehow is stored in such clauses. And then the program consists of this knowledge thing, so it's a collection of such clauses, and then a query. And now comes the query afterwards. So here's the query. The query could be just one literal. It could also be a conjunction of literals. And then the question is this, does the query hold? That's the question. And now the query may contain variables. So that is, the answer either is yes, it holds in full generality, or it holds only if the variables have certain values. And then the answer is such a kind of binding of the variables to values. Okay? Now, so that makes it kind of a, so the kind of the terminology which I use is more or less in this logical, has this logical appeal, but now our goal is to implement it, and so that does not help us so much. So what we have to compare it with the categories we think of, and the things we think of is procedures, procedure calls, sequences of statements. So these are things which we understand, and in that sense, yes, there is kind of a procedural view to such kind of Prolog programs. And so the analogy is the following, that the predicates in some sense correspond to procedures. So that is kind of the highlight of our intuition. Now, if the predicate is a procedure, then if I have a clause, then this... So then if you have a literal, then this is kind of a procedure call. Because the think of the query, if there's a literal... If there's a literal in the query, then the question is, please prove, then the task is, please prove this literal. And in some sense, what we do is, well, we can conclude that this literal holds if we find a clause for it, so which somehow matches the literal, and the body of the clause holds. Yeah? So this means, in some sense, this is like a procedure call. Yeah? So instead, in order to conclude the head of the clause, we prove the body. So we descend in going in stepping through the body, and if we successfully executed the body, then everything is fine. Then the procedure successfully has terminated. Yeah? So in this sense, a literal is a procedure call. So that is the next thing which we kind of, which our intuition tells us. Now there's only one thing. So what is the procedure definition? So the procedure definition, so this, what was it? That was this block thing, which consisted of the statements consisting the body which has to be executed when the procedure is called. So that is, seems to be the body of the clause. Now that, now you see one very important thing, that the same predicate may be defined by multiple clauses. And this now makes the difference to ordinary procedures, which we know from C. What is the difference? Now there are multiple definitions of the same procedure. So that means we kind of have that's kind of a non-determinism. In some sense, in order to prove the goal, it doesn't matter whether we use the first clause, the second clause, or the third clause. And if the first clause doesn't work, we take the second one. So it's kind of either we can think of it as non-deterministic choice between the different clauses, or that is perhaps not so deterministic. We might impose kind of an operational behavior in that we first try the first implementation of the procedure, namely the first clause. If we fail with that, okay, bad luck, then we try the next one, and so on. And until we find a clause which kind of helps us to prove to meet our goals, which means to prove the query. Yeah? And if we fail completely, okay, then the query is wrong. That is the idea. Now this analogy kind of provides us with kind of a strong intuition what we really have to do when we want to implement such a prologue program. Now then, that was kind of the control structure. Now what kind of values does a prologue program operate on? Now the values it operates on, these are the terms. These are the values. Now there are also variables, yes, but there is no kind of assignment. So we do not assign a value to a variable, but what we do have is bindings. It's in some sense similar, only that a variable, in the course of time, when we execute a clause and we have bound a variable to something, we are not allowed to rebind it. So the binding is fixed for the whole clause. Yeah, so that is one thing. But clearly, if the one clause fails, then the binding was wrong. And then we kind of have to then we are free to choose another binding for the variable. So this makes it, treatment of the variables a bit different from variables in imperative languages, because every variable is, in successful execution, every variable is bound only once. So this makes it different from imperative languages. But there's also a difference to functional languages, because there's something like that the execution of a procedure may fail. And then the variables are unbound, and we may try other bindings to the variables. So in this sense, this unbinding of variables, this is something which we typically do not have in functional languages. So in that sense, prologue is different, has different features compared both to functional and to imperative languages. Okay. Now, okay, so that is the question then is, at which, where in our program we can enforce that the variable is bound to something? If the binding, if this is the key step, then where do we do this binding? And that is the unification. So this is this unification operation where somewhere in our program we have explicitly stated x equals f of y. This means whatever value y has, x is bound to f of this value of y. Likewise, whatever value x is bound to, it should start with an f, and what comes under the f, this is the value to which y is bound. So in this sense, this is not an assignment going from right to left, but it's a bidirectional thing. The value of x moves into the y, and the value of y moves into the x. Okay? So this is because it's a unification operation. The two terms on the left and on the right are made equal. Okay? So that is one thing. And this update does... That is the basic computation step. And this binding of variables is kind of a side effect of executing this statement. So it is... So think of... I said here... deliberate, it was not by an accident that here these predicates I called procedures. Because a procedure may fail, yes, but if it succeeds, well, the value is true. This is not very informative, but in the course of this successful execution of the query, the certain variables inside the query have been bound to values. So that and this binding of the variables in the query, this can be considered as a side effect of executing the procedure. So therefore, we should kind of think of this the effect taking place of executing a procedure as a side effect, meaning, and the side effect consists in binding the variables in between. Okay? So that is, so in that sense, here down there I have collected some key issues which I more or less have already now explained to you. So therefore, a predicate call, in contrast to functional languages, or similar to procedures, does not have a return value if it is successful, but it may fail. And if it fails, then this non-deterministic choice is somehow to be implemented, or must somehow be non-deterministic choice must be implemented by means of backtracking. So that means whenever the first definition of a procedure fails, then we try the next one. And also, it is procedures what we have to deal with because the effect is realized by means of side effects. And that is, and now you may wonder, how do we do that side effects? How do we realize them? Well, very simple. We only have to, this is done when we implement the unification. At every unification, such a side effect is realized. And then simply control proceeds, and in the end, if everything is fine, the unification steps, which have occurred in between, have done the work. Okay. Yes?
May I turn off the lights in the front because the connection is
wrong? Yes, so how can I do it? Ah, you can do it. Very, very nice. Okay. If you do not get too sleepy, Monday morning is perhaps hard time, but it's not so early in the morning anymore, and perhaps it's not so boring. So I don't know. At least I guess this. While I guess some of you have experience with imperative languages, and some of you have experiences with functional languages, this. I think this one is at least definitely probably new to you. Or whoever has seen such kind of things. Also this kind of implementation tricks? Or only the prologue thing you have seen?
Only prologue.
So So I think maybe I have told you that already, but when one has a real prologue, programs are hard to understand, in particular if there are cuts. And so in particular, the flow of control in prologue programs is very complicated and involved. And so in that sense, having a kind of getting a glimpse of how the implementation works is very helpful also to understand what the prologue program does. Okay. So now what is the architecture of our virtual machine for prologue? And this is called Vim, in order to honor Reinhard Wilhelm, who kind of triggered this type of constructions. But in reality, I don't know whether I have told you that, this machine has been constructed by Christian Fecht, who was a PhD student at Saarbrücken, and a PhD student of Reinhard Wilhelm. And now he's working in that. He's kind of some kind of technical engineer at SAP, at least the last time when I met him. But he designed that, and it should be, this Vim should be kind of put, considered in comparison with the VAM. The VAM is the Warren Abstract Machine. This is the original machine for Prologue. And the VAM is very complicated. And the Vim is, compared to that, extremely simple, but is virtually equally efficient as the VAM. But the Vim is much more in this, it is just in the same style as the other machines. This makes it attractive. Yes, and the, so, in my, but actually, there's also some kind of contribution of myself in the Vim. I have further simplified the Vim a little bit and made it even more similar to the other machines, so that there's virtually no difference anymore. So that is, and I also inserted some of the, re-implemented some of the optimizations provided by the VAM also in the Vim, so that it's more realistic now. Okay, so now what is the Vim? So the, we want to do it, so it should be exactly the same like the other machines. So that means that we have a separate code store, yes, and we call it C. And there's the PC, which points to the next instruction to be executed. That's all what we know, and that's all what we are familiar with. And also, there is this standard convention, every memory cell may hold a full instruction. Okay, so then we have also our famous runtime stack. Yes, and it looks, the runtime stack is looks quite similar to the runtime stack of the MAMA, in that sense that we only care about the occupied memory cells. So we do not, so here, in contrast to the C machine, there's nothing, so we do not use anything. We don't care about this upper part in the section, but only look at the runtime stack and maintain that. And the stack pointer points to the topmost element. That's what is always the case in our machines. And there's also a frame pointer. And the frame pointer points to the current stack frame, yes. So there is something like a stack frame. What will we use stack frames for? Well, that's for procedure calls, which means for literals. Therefore, we will use the frame pointer. And we will use the frame pointer also to access variables, local variables, which are the local variables. So in some sense, so I have not, maybe I write a little example again. If I write something like that, for example, yeah, okay, so that is like a kind of prologue syntax, but I kind of may also use, write it like that to be in our, more consistent to our, to the kind of stylized Prolog, which we use here. So if I have a clause like that, the x is a local variable, because the same this x, the scope of this x is the clause. And so there is outside, if I have another clause, then the x there is a different x. So maybe that is was what you have naturally expected from right when I wrote down such clauses. But this makes the x's local variables. So in fact, by that you see there are no global variables. There are only local variables in Prolog. Yeah? And yeah, that is what I want. Yes. Okay? And so all these local variables in the clauses, they are maintained on the in a stack frame, and they are addressed relative to the frame pointer. Okay, so then there will also be dynamic data types, if you like, and that is therefore that we will rely on a heap. And now, what kind of dynamic values might we have? So there are the terms. And the terms, like in the functional world, the terms are constructed and maintained on the heap. And what we maintain on the stack is then only pointers to these objects in the heap. Yeah, and so the heap is again a data. You could kind of consider that the heap as an abstract data type, like in the MAMA, but that's not completely sufficient, or at least for efficiency reasons, people like to organize the heap not as a just abstract data type, but as a stack, and that means that we allocate. Things when we allocate, so we kind of push things on top of the heap stack. But that also means that if I, and that is important because there's this there's this backtracking thing, and when we backtrack, we have the problem that in one go, a huge amount of terms which we have constructed have become obsolete. And they have to be removed very quickly. How can we do it? Well, we can do it if they are sitting on top of the stack, and we kind of are able to pop the stack. And then all these objects are deallocated very quickly. Yeah, so therefore, we like to allocate to maintain the heap in a stack by means like a stack. Okay, so that is for the heap in general. Now, in detail, there are objects. Will sit several objects, depending on what kind of values we would have to allocate on the heap. They have will receive tags to identify these objects, and that is as in the MAMA machine. And we clearly also need a new instruction which allocates an object on the heap. Now here come the list of objects, and now this is already a complete list of objects which we might want to allocate on the heap. So the first thing is there is atoms like this, and there is a tag for it, which is A, and there are structs, and the tag for it is S, and there is also the structs. They also constructor applications, so they also need the information. So the atom needs the information what kind of atom it is, so this is this little a, and the constructor needs information about the name of the constructor, this is this f, but additionally also the number of arguments of the constructor, because in Prolog since there's no type checking, you can use the F with as many arguments as you like, with 2, with 3, with 4. And now the question is, what happens with these several Fs? Is it always the same? Is it always different? And the design choice in Prolog is that these are always different. So in this sense, the number of arguments is part of the constructor name. So therefore, I write it with this vertical, with this bar, with this slash. And so now here we kind of take the, since we kind of have to maintain everything on the stack, then the question is how much space does the tag and the F and the N consume in comparison to the references which follow. And here the design choice, well, it is debatable whether this is that this organizational information S together with F and N consume one memory cell. And the same is true for the tag together with the name of the atom. This always consumes one memory cell. So this is perhaps not so problematic if you think of that there are only three tags which we use. So that means we need two bits only. And even if we have a 32-bit architecture, then we still have 30 bits for the rest. And so that would be the name of the constructor and the arity. And typically, constructors do not have arities beyond 1,000. So this means 10 bits would be sufficient for the N. And so there's still a decent number of bits remains for the F. Yeah? So in this sense, there's no problem there to put it into one memory cell. And if you have a 64-bit architecture, then everything is, there's no problem anymore anyway. Okay, so that is, but that is kind of debatable, and one might use it another numbering or organization there. The only thing is that the organizational information is the lowest, and one may think of that this has maybe address, when allocated, may have address 5 in the heap, and then this has 6, 7, 8, and 9. So it increases towards the arguments. That is one thing, which, and this is important because of the stack organization of the heap. Now, the more that is no big surprise. This is a little bit of convention. The more interesting thing is the treatment of variables. Because terms we have learned, or I have insisted upon, may contain variables. And so we have to, therefore, to allocate objects in the heap for the variables in terms. And these objects are references. So these are references to other terms. And now these get also a tag, which is this R for reference. And it also, then there is one more thing which one might wonder about. What is if the variable is unbound? So sometimes a variable is bound, and sometimes it has not yet a value. But if it has not yet a value, we could also consider the variable to be bound to itself. And that is, and for that we can nicely represent by means of a self loop. So this represents an unbound variable, and if we want to check a variable to be whether it is unbound or not, then we kind of simply check whether it points to itself. Okay. That was this. Is there a question? So then now we successively try to solve certain subtasks. And in the beginning, we perhaps do not yet even know how we do not know the big picture. But there might be a situation when there is a term written in the in our program, and we want to create a heap representation for it. Yeah, this is this, and for that we need a sequence of instructions. And that is this code A scheme. This is receives a term as an argument and an address environment and should kind of build up a representation of the term T in the heap. So this is a simple task about which we can only laugh. Yeah. So this is, we know how to, why this should not be difficult. Yeah. So, and therefore, so the result of it should be a representation of executing the code. This code should be a representation of T in the heap and a reference to it on top of the stack. And now how would we do that? Now the simple idea is, well, if we have what did we do when we had to translate an expression, say an arithmetic expression? We made kind of a depth first order traversal somehow. So recursively evaluated the arguments of the topmost operator and then applied the operator. And that we would do here also. We first create the representations for the arguments of the topmost constructor. Then we have two references to it on the stack, or k if the constructor has k arguments, and then we kind of in the end apply one instruction of our virtual machine, which constructs the representation of the constructor in the heap and returns the reference. That's it. Yeah? So that means the root constructor is constructed last. And this is kind of a post-order traversal over the tree. And so that means, and as an effect, if we have consider, for example, such kind of tree expression, so there we have three variables inside. Now, what do we do for these variables? So there is, we distinguish two things. Either the variable is already initialized, that means, or it is not yet been initialized. These x, y, and z are variables which syntactically occur in T. And T occurs in a clause. And this means that these are x, y, and z are variables of the clause. So they are local variables. And so that means there are in our stack frame, we find references for these variables. And if the variable is already initialized, then the corresponding stack frame already points to something where the value for x is sitting. Yeah? And that means that this value should be put into the term t. Or actually the x should point to this beast. The x of the clause should point to this beast, and otherwise, if it is an uninitialized, then what should we do then? Well, then we create So that means that the first thing is for all the x's and the y's, we create references at least for x, y, and z there should be somewhere a reference object. And what was it? The x already was initialized, so this means that the reference object for x is already available. It is already sitting somewhere. And we can refer to it. For the other ones which have not yet been initialized, so therefore I make them yellow. For these we will allocate new R objects with self references. And according to the DFS post order traversal, we first will process the X, then we process the Y, then we process the G, then we process the A, then the Z. What? So that was 5. And then the F. And in this order, the objects should sit in the stack. And that means that we first allocate the successors, we first have that the objects corresponding to the arguments of a newly allocated constructor are sitting below. Yeah? So that is in this, accordingly, all the references go downward in the stack. And that is nice, because if we if a memory cell is only pointed to by higher memory cells, then popping the stack will not create dangling references. So in this sense, these are good pointers. Okay? So therefore, this depth first post-order traversal is the convenient way. Okay, so now what kind of code do we the schemes for code A, the code A code. How does it look like? Okay, so the first thing is if we make a case distinction according to all forms, how a term can be can look like. So for an atom, okay, so that means we have to create an atom in the heap and return a reference to it. Now we have not yet any possibility to do so, so we simply invent a new instruction. And the same thing, if there's a variable which is initialized or uninitialized, we also have not yet a method to allocate them or to treat them properly. Therefore, we create new instructions for that. And in order to deal with this distinction of initialized and uninitialized variables, so that so initialized variables are indicated by overline. So that means if there is no overlining, then this is the first occurrence of the variable in the clause. It's not in the head, so that I must say. So initialized variables are marked by this overlining, and for them we assume that there is already this ref object there, and in the stack frame we have a reference to this object, and then we use an instruction which is this put ref, and if it's an uninitialized variable then we have this put var. And also there could be that our term contains this anonymous variable indicated by this underscore beast, and then we have this put anonymous. Yeah. And then the only thing what remains is what do we do if we have a composite term, so a constructor F applied to n arguments. Well, then we first recursively generate the code for producing the T1 to TN, and then only in the end we do this, we put the struct. Okay, so what we have to recall, all these instructions are put atom, put var, put, so they're all put instructions. Yeah, and we have to distinguish between initialized and uninitialized variables. That's it. And a post-order traversal. And then, now we know how the code scheme is, so that we, for that, in this sense, we immediately can, we do not yet in detail know how the put instructions are implemented, but still we are able already to generate code. And in particular for this beast, where X, Y, and Z are kind of, have relative addresses 1, 2, and 3, we first have to do the X, which is the put ref 1. Then we have to do the Y. Y is uninitialized, therefore put var 2. Then we put the put struct G 2. So now we have the first argument of F. Then the second argument of F is this put atom A. The third argument is this put var 3. And then we do the put struct for the outermost constructor F, with three arguments. And now you see, this is not very complicated, and even here, since the axis, so we address relative to the frame pointer. If the relative address is 2, then the 2 will occur in the code. So we have a one-to-one correspondence between the names of the variables and really the addresses occurring in the code. And so this code is very transparent and very clear. Okay? Now, the hard work. We have to implement these fabulous handful of instructions. So put atom is the easiest. This means we allocate the atom on the heap and put a reference on, return a reference to it on the stack, and for that we simply refer to this fabulous new instruction provided for our heap. And I guess we have a similar instruction we had also in the MAMA thing. So now for the put var, it's a little bit more complicated. So the first thing is, so the variable I is not yet initialized. So there is no reference object has been allocated for I so far. So therefore, we create a new one, and it is unbound because it is new. And then we kind of put a reference to it on top of the stack. So that is the first thing. But we then do one more thing. And this is, henceforth, the variable x is initialized. It is not bound, but it is initialized because the ref object is already there. So therefore, we copy it to the corresponding place, the reference. We copy the reference to the corresponding place in our stack frame. This means, because if in some other place the x will then be bound, our current term will kind of sense it because it points to the ref object, to the same ref objects. Yeah? So the communication is through the ref object, but the reference to this ref object is maintained on the stack, in the stack frame. Okay? Is there a question? So this was the put var. And now the put anonymous. This is an anonymous variable. This is a variable which is not maintained on the stack. So it is not a local variable. Actually, we do not care about its value. So therefore, it is kind of put. So the ref object is created, yes, but it's maintained only on this. It is only put. A reference to it is only put on top of the stack. So the only point, the only consumer, if you like, of this R object is the current term and nothing else. Okay. Okay. Then the. So that was this anonymous variable. Now, for the put ref, this is a little bit more complicated. There, we assume that the variable has already been initialized. This means in our stack frame at relative address I, there is a pointer to some value. And this pointer is then copied on top of the stack. But it's not copied directly. Before it is copied, there is this deref going on beforehand. What does this deref mean? Well, here this pointer here may point to an R object, which may point to another R object, which may point to an atom, for example. Then all this reference chain we could copy it, yes, but that would make it inefficient because then we would always follow this reference chain. Now instead of doing that, we kind of directly copy the reference to the latest, to the value to the, at the end of this reference chain. So this is this DREF. Yeah, so that constructs chains of references. So it follows the ref, the references in these R objects until it we arrive at a value. Where, what kind of a value, what would a value be? Well, it would be either an atom or a struct or an uninitialized variable. So because a self loop, we should not kind of follow. Okay? So this is what the DREF does. Okay, so that is the implementation of the. This was the implementation of the of the, this the variables. Now comes the put struct. Now put struct is not so difficult. So we assume that we have, or from left to right, we have evaluated the arguments. So in this ordering, we have on top of the stack the references. They should be put onto the heap in this order. But below this block of references, we have to insert first the organizational information that we have a struct here, that the name of the constructor is F, and that the number of references to come is N. And happens here. So here I construct an empty, if you like, an empty struct of length n with for the f and the s for the f, and then I kind of copy the references on top of the stack into this. I copy it into the struct, which means in the memory cells, just following this. This S F comma N F slash N element, and then in the end pop the stack and return on top of the stack the reference to the bottommost memory cell of this struct. Okay. So that is, so that was all what the construction of terms is about. We have noticed that the putref kind of takes care of a binding of the variable xi, which is already available, and copies the reference to the binding of this variable on top of the stack, but it does not copy the reference it contains directly, but before it copies, it does the DREF. Yeah. Okay. Now. Okay. So then now comes the terms. This was not so difficult. Now comes the translation of literals, which perhaps is more interesting. And so this is the first interesting thing. So literals, as we said, these are procedure calls. And now what do we do? Our immediate question is, what do we do for a procedure call in our Prolog machine? And the idea is, okay, so we have not so many ideas. So the only idea which we had so far is we allocate a stack frame. So now what is the stack frame good for? The stack frame is good for providing us some organizational cells so that we can return to the caller. So that is the thing. And then it provides this frame pointer and the space for the local variables. And that means first we provide the space for the organizational cells and fill them as good as we can. Then inside this stack frame, we will provide. So there are certain local variables which are special. These are the local variables which occur in the head. These are the these are kind of formal parameters. These are special locals, and they are initialized with the actual parameters. So that means we construct for that we construct the actual parameters in the heap and provide references to these actual parameters in these formal parameters. So these are the values of the formals, and so these are then afterwards these are initialized. And once we have provided the actual parameters, what we did before, we had this call instruction in C or this apply in the functional world. In the functional world, this apply was, and also in the C world, we could not just jump to or call a particular procedure. We first had dynamically determine the procedure. In C code which you look at, this is not so apparent because in most cases the name of the function is right there. But it could also be just a function pointer which has to be evaluated in an arbitrarily complicated by means of an arbitrarily complicated expression. And in the functional languages, you have these higher order somethings, so you have to compute a lot, perhaps, in order just to arrive at the function. So here it's much simpler. So the procedure which we want to call is the predicate, and the predicate is right there. So we just see the predicate and we can call it. So in this sense, it is much easier. So here is therefore the code, and you see here we do not even since we kind of so there is nothing like a dynamic number of arguments or so. Therefore, we can use a very simple addressing scheme. Everything is addressed relative to the frame pointer, and so we first do the marking for constructing the stack frame. Then we just put the actual parameters, and then we call the procedure. Yeah, so the code is extremely simple. So this mark, the B is the continuation address where we continue if the call succeeds. So this is the success address. The continuation address in the successful case. And here this is just a call to the procedure. And again, the P is the name of the predicate in the literal, and the K is the number of arguments, and the same name P is considered to denote a different predicate if the number of arguments is different. So therefore, K is part of the predicate name. Okay? And in between, now we see why we had this fabulous code A. There we construct the terms. So we know how to do it. Yeah. So this means if we have now this great literal, which occurs somewhere in a clause. Yeah. If it occurs, this is a literal occurring somewhere in the clause where the X, well, we assume that, I think it's not completely realistic in that sense that the X is the first. It is realistic, yes. It is possible that this is a realistic literal in some clause. And the X is uninitialized, so this means in particular the X does not occur in the head of the surrounding clause. And then there comes another X. But this is the second occurrence of the X, so this X, because the first occurrence of the X has initialized, the code for it has initialized the X, so the second occurrence of the X will no longer be fresh, so therefore X in this place is initialized, therefore the bar. And then the Y is again a new one. And the whole thing, so then here we see now how the code looks like. So first we do the marking, and in the end we do the calling. And in between we construct the arguments and the construction. So this constructs the first argument, this constructs the second argument, and here we have, for the third argument, we have to construct this G applied to X and Y. So we first do the X. X is the second occurrence of X, therefore put ref. Then a put var for the Y. And then the put struct G2 for the term. And please note, that is something which I kind of also may... I have kind of silently... taking that for granted, but I may make it explicit also, that here I take the liberty to call P, to use the name of the procedure directly there, and do not do things like maintaining the predicate name in address environment and then call that beast which is sitting there. Yeah, I just use the name here. In a real implementation, you would not have call a string, but call kind of, it depends on what the compiler has, how the compiler internally has represented the predicates. Okay, so but that's the code. Still, I have not yet explained to you what the mark does and what the call does, and so we have to, for doing that, we kind of have to know how the stack frame of the Vim is organized. So the first thing which we observe is that, so that is what we what I have promised you. So down here we have some organizational cells. So this is this green block. And you perhaps also notice that the green block now has, so it has this positive continuation address. This is the PC old, which we had also in the MAMA and in the SEMA. And the old frame pointer. So these are the two things, the two familiar references which we have to store inside this, in these organizational cells. But then comes some more, and quite a number of more things, namely four beasts. And that is the reason for so many extra cells is this, since we have to organize this backtracking. And these are used, these four cells are used for that. Okay, so then comes the local variables on top. So this is no surprise. These are the local variables occurring in the... so the stack frame is... So the local variables contain of consist of two compartments. So these are the actual the formal parameters. These are always the same. They are provided and filled in when at the call. But then when we have start to execute one clause, then some more locals might show up, because the clause may have, besides the variables occurring in the head, there could be more variables in the clause. And these are sitting on top of it. Yeah. So these are the local variables. And then on top of it is some stack. Here it is some local stack, and that is... has various purposes, among the, in particular for doing some kind of local computation. Yeah? So that is sitting on top of it. In fact, speaking aside, this local stack may be arbitrarily deep in the implementation of the Vim. So this is not so that I can statically say it has depths, so that the difference between that the locals are only maximally five cells away from the stack pointer. This is not the case. They can be arbitrarily far away. But since we address the locals by means of the frame pointer, that's no problem for us. Okay. So that I have already explained. These four extra memory cells will be later used when we do the backtracking. So now comes the marking. So what does it do? Okay, so the mark does, so at least we can do only what we know, and that is we have to allocate six memory cells, and the B This is the positive continuation address, is provided by the mark instruction. This is put on top, and the frame pointer, which is the current frame pointer, is the second topmost, the value of the second topmost stack cell, and that's it. Okay, so that I guess that we it's not so it's conveniently simple. Now for the call, also the call is not so hard. We know that n is the number of actual parameters. So they, when the call is executed, they are sitting on top of the stack. And the memory cell below, this is where the new frame pointer starts. So the old frame pointer we have stored away, but the new frame pointer is set by the call. And it is set to this memory, to this memory cell, which is has distance n from the stack, from the top of the stack. And that is for the frame pointer. That is initialized at the call, and additionally we jump to the start point of the procedure, which for simplicity I label also by p/n. So if I had kind of an address environment also for start points of procedures, I could use address 5 or so. So it's a kind of symbolic reference into the code section. Yeah? So this is also easy enough. So now we can do calls. And so we have the translation of literals. Clearly, what then happens when we jump to the predicate P, this is a different story, and this might be not so easy, but for the literal itself, it's easy. So that was one. Now we have the literal. So let us now proceed to the other kind of goals, which is a unification. That is kind of important because, that is, as I told you, the key computation step, like the assignment in C. So unification is the key operation, and therefore we have to think about it. Now, there's a little bit of a difference between, so in some, maybe this case distinction is not so, we could have written it, but everything what comes later, just three instances of it, namely always when a variable is already initialized, is uninitialized, or is anonymous. But we could also simplify a little bit our task by by combining these three things into a macro, which is this put macro. So, and this takes the variable and the information, what kind of variable it is, and then produces the corresponding put instruction. So it's like this get var thing which we had in the MAMA. Okay? So in this x tilde kind of indicates the three forms what an x could be. Okay, so now we come to our fabulous unification thing, and it is this. Is the form. So there's an X and there's a T. And now what can we do? So the idea is we put the X on top of the stack, we put the T on top of the stack, and then we do the unification. So at least this is what we expect what should be doing. And now for the you put the X on top of the stack means, so depending on whether X is already is initialized or uninitialized, put a either create something or just put a reference to something which has already been created on top of the stack. So this could be done by means of this put thing. And now this T, we could kind of, what does it mean to put T on top of the stack? So T is a new term, so we might construct it in the heap. And we have this code A for doing so, and this leaves us a second reference on top of the stack, namely the reference to the T. And then we have two references on top of the stack to two terms. And then we have to unify these terms to make them equal and to introduce bindings between the variables inside these two terms. And that is, we don't know how to do it, but we kind of might invent an instruction to do it, and this gives us this code. So the code is easy. The implementation might not so easy, at least the implementation of this weird instruction. Yeah? So the put X will, so that we know, the code A we know, but the unify we don't know. But the code is easy, so if we have this unification statement in our code, and we have X is initialized, Y and Z is not initialized, and U also is already initialized. So what would we have to do? U is the fourth variable, so therefore a put ref for putting the U. And then we have to put the code for this FG A thing, and that is this one. This code we have already generated. So I plug it in. And then in the end comes the new instruction unify. Yeah? And now clearly the question is, what should unify do? Yeah, so the code is easy. You understand the code, I guess, immediately. Okay? Now the unification. This is so complicated that I am not able to implement it directly, but I delegated to my fabulous runtime system. So the runtime system must provide me with this function unify, which takes two references, walks, then through, it's not a single step thing, but it just has to walk through the terms and compare them constructor-wise, and then if it finds a variable there and a term there, has to make a binding. Yeah? So here by that, so you suddenly see that the instruction unify is also not so complicated. It calls this runtime function unify and then throws away the two references on top of the stack because they have been just put there in order to indicate, please, these are the arguments for the unify runtime function. And then the effect is produced by a side effect, by the binding, and so no value is returned. Yeah, so before and after the unify, the stack is the same. But somehow the unification has taken place. So now, again, so suddenly this unify instruction turns out to be also not so difficult. You see, just two lines, but it contains the call to this dark function unify. And now we have to reason about this runtime function unify. What does it do? Now we can concentrate just on this unification thing, where on top of the stack we have two heap addresses, two pointers into the heap, and additionally we may guarantee that these are maximally dereferenced. So it's not so that on top of the stack is the reference to a reference to a reference to a reference. Why is this so? Well, so let us go back here to this one, or maybe to this example code. So here, this is a putref instruction. So the putref instruction does this dereferencing. So it has built in this dereferencing. So therefore, that's fine. And this one is a construction code. And the construction code is always either returns directly a pointer to an atom, a struct, or an unbound variable, or it has something which is produced by this putref, so it's also maximally dereferenced. So we really have on top of the stack two things which are maximally dereferenced, And now comes this runtime function unify. And the first thing is, okay, so the things must be made equal. Now, if they are already equal, then nothing is to be done. So that is a simple check. So therefore, it first checks whether the references are to the same thing. And if so, fine, nothing happens. Otherwise, it tries to bind. So otherwise, one of the references could be to an unbound variable. Yeah, if the one of them is to an unbound variable, then so if one is to an unbound variable and the other one is not to a variable but to an atom or a struct, then it's clear we bind the variable. The only problematic thing where we have a choice is when both are unbound variables. Then either we bind, which one should we bind? Should we bind to the other one? And the idea is that the younger one is bound to the older one, which gets so that the references go down in the stack and not up. So that's the idea. So that we always bind younger variables, so this means larger addresses, to older variables. And so that's in some sense the whole thing. And if the two things point to atoms both, we compare the atoms for equality. And if they're equal, fine. And if they're different, we blow up. And if we both point to a struct, the same thing. We recursively descend to comparing the arguments. Yeah? And so that's it. In principle, but there are three things to be taken into account. The first thing is, and I guess this example I have already shown you, it could happen that we have something like an x equals f of x. And there we said it fails. So, but if I just take the variable x on the left-hand side, okay, it is unbound. It's an unbound variable. Then we could, and on the right-hand side is a term, so we could bind x to f of x. But this is bad, because then we introduce a cycle. And we have a cyclic term. And it might be, instead we want to fail this unification statement. That is, in order, before, when we have a variable x and want to bind it to an f, to a term, we first have to check whether the term to which we bind the x, whether this contains x or not. If it contains x, we should fail. If it does not, we can do the binding. So this kind of thing is known as the occur check in Prolog. And in unification, implementing unification. Okay, so that we have to do. Then the next thing is another thing which we should kind of be aware of, that unification may fail. So this happens if the terms to be unified, one is A and the other one is B, or an atom and a constructed term, a thing, if we try to unify incomparable things, then unification should fail. And then backtracking should be initiated. We actually do not yet know what to do when backtracking is initiated, but we have to initiate it. So we will. It's like with this eval thing, which we had in the MAMA. We did not know what to do when we hit a closure, but we know we will have to evaluate it. And so we always generated the eval thing and only later filled in this placeholder, and the same is with the backtracking. So we will have to initiate backtracking, although we do not yet know what will happen when we backtrack. But for the backtracking, one thing we know: when we have a clause, and during execution of the clause, we bind some variables, and then things go wrong. Then we have to undo our bindings. So in that sense, we better should kind of keep track of things which we bound. Yeah? because in order to be able to do the undoing. And this is, we require the possibility of recording bindings. Okay, so that kind of gives us implementation of this function unify. So the function unify returns true if everything goes right and wrong, and otherwise it returns false. Yeah. Okay. So it requires two references, U and V. What does it do? So we said the first thing to be done is compare them for equality. If they are equal, everything is fine, and things terminate immediately. Otherwise, it checks whether the first reference points to the first address, if you like, points to a reference, to an R object, that is, to a variable. And then we check whether the other one also is an R object. Since U and V are maximally dereferenced, when they go to an R object, then this must be a self-reference. So this must be an unbound variable. So here is the case of two unbound variables. Now then, we check whether U is larger than V. This U is younger. And then we bind U to V. Yeah, so that the U at position U, we place a reference to V. So U is bound to V. And then additionally, now I make that perhaps in blue, this is this trailing. We do not yet know what the trailing really does, but we call a kind of runtime function which records that U has been bound. Then everything is fine and we kind of return true. Now, in the opposite situation is that V is larger than U, and then V is bound, and again we trail the V now, and everything is fine. Okay, so now the other thing is that, so this was the case when U and V were pointed where the addresses of variables. Now, otherwise, U is still a variable, but V is no longer a variable. Then we have to do this checking. We have to do this occur checking. And so this is this beast here. Maybe I give up all this color thing. And now let's go here. So here we do this. We check whether check compares the variable addressed by U and the term addressed by V, and whether the term addressed by V contains the U. If this is if the check succeeds, which means that the variable does not occur, then we may do the binding. So here is the fabulous binding. We record the binding. This is here, and are happy. That is return true. Else, so if this means if the term addressed by V contains the variable addressed by U, then we are doomed, and therefore we have to backtrack. And we indicate that something went wrong by returning false. Okay? So that was the case where U is a variable. The case where V is a variable and U is not a variable is the same. Again, now we have to check. We have to check whether U contains V, and if not, we may do the binding, do the trailing, and returning true, and otherwise backtrack and return false. Okay, so these were the cases where variables are involved. Now the cases where no variables are involved, these are much easier. Because if both are atoms and equal atoms, then everything is fine. And if both are structs and the same structs, Then we iterate over the successors. We iterate over the successors. And if we dereference maximally the successors, and if they do not unify, we return false. Otherwise, we return true. Yeah. So we, for each successor, we call the unify, and as soon as one of the unification fails, we return false. That is, jump out of the for loop. Sorry, one second. Otherwise, we go through, we iterate through all the successors, and if we succeed with that, we in the end return true. And now, in all other cases, when neither we have equal structs or equal atoms, then we go to backtrack and return false. And now your question. Where do you want to insert a backtrack?
For the return false where there is the backtrack.
You mean?
Yes.
Here. But there has already been called backtrack at the first place where the unification failed.
Okay,
yes. Yeah. So this is kind of, if the recursive calls failed, but then they immediately, as soon as something fails, you call the backtrack. And the backtrack you see here does some kind of work, but it does not jump out of the, it's not kind of an exception which is raised, but it's just a function which is called. So it makes some kind of things, but it does not, it's no exception in the sense. Okay, so that was the code for this D thing. Let us see how it works. So assume we have these on the stack. We have references to these two structs. So this means here on the stack, we have a pointer to that and a pointer to that. And this means, so these green things are the things which are compared. So these are structs. So something happens. So the algorithm will then consider the first element of the struct and compare them. So this is this one with this one. So maybe it's too light to see. So maybe I kind of extra. So we proceed here and there. You see that I did maximally dereferencing before I do the recursive call of the unify. And in this case, the R is unbound variable and the A is A. So this reference is created, and now comes the algorithm proceeds with unification of the second arguments. So these are two unbound variables which must be unified. And then this one here has a higher address, so therefore a reference in this direction is created. And then things have successfully terminated, and unification is done. And that means unification is done, so that these two references, which were sitting on the stack, they are popped and they go away. But as an effect, we have achieved that this variable is bound, and this variable is also bound. Okay. And so everything, so still, so now we have this fabulous runtime function, and in this sense, implemented this unify instruction. So this unify instruction looks harmless, but does a lot of work. You see, all this unification thing goes on, and still we have not yet completed the unify instruction completely, because we kind of did it at the expense of three auxiliary functions, which we have to look at separately. So this was the recording of the bindings, the backtracking, whatever that might be, and the occur checking. And Yeah, and for that, I guess we have learned enough for today, at least in this lecture. Maybe you have other lectures still to come, and we continue here tomorrow. Thank you very much.